from GPB News. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. You know, communication is not always easy.
Do you understand the words that are coming out of my mouth?
Today, we'll explore whether men and women naturally communicate differently, and we'll also explore the gender bias that female lawyers have faced for generations. That's coming up. First, though, we spoke yesterday about the food renaissance in Athens. Athens-based food writer Rebecca Lang told us about the city's culinary boom.
We've been that college town with a lot of hamburgers and wings, and now, you know, you can pretty much go out to eat and have exactly what you want, and I really think that Athens could easily compete with Atlanta. I've said before, I think Athens food can compete with New York.
At least one Athens resident can attest to that. Angela Griffin lives there, and she left us this message about some of her favorite restaurants.
First of all, World Famous has great bar food if you're looking for a low price point. If people will venture over to the south side, there's new things over there. And, I mean, Donna Chain's doing a new spin on, you know, classic Chinese food. There's great bar food at the Rural Peasant. Their fish and chips are great. Just a few places I wanted to mention.
It is so great to get recommendations on eateries from people that live there. So if your community has a world-class restaurant, call us like Angela did at 404-500-9457. You can also reach us on Facebook or on Twitter. It's at OST Talk, and we might feature your comments on the show. Who has not heard this jingle around the holidays? That's Coca-Cola's signature tune. Every year, the Atlanta-based company releases a slew of holiday ads that are almost as traditional as eggnog. The Coke ads of the 1930s are largely credited with inventing our modern conception of Santa Claus. And in the 1990s, Coke began featuring their iconic polar bears. We'll now explore the history of Coca-Cola's Christmas marketing with author Mark Pendergrast. He's a leading expert on Coke, and he wrote the book For God, Country, and Coca-Cola. Mark, it's good to have you back.
Good to be here.
So what do we know about how these ads began, the original ads going back to the 1930s?
Well, in 1931, Coca-Cola hired an artist named Haddon Sundblom to create a Santa Claus ad. Now, you have to remember, in those days, Coke primarily relied on magazine advertising, and they would hire really fine artists such as N.C. Wyeth or Norman Rockwell to create heartwarming ads. And Sundblom at first used a retired Coca-Cola man as his model, but when he died, he used himself.
For Santa.
Yeah, for Santa. And he created what really is the modern image of Santa Claus. Until then, Santa was sort of tall and gaunt in European tradition. He often wore not just red, but green or yellow or blue. And so Sundblom created a large, jolly, Coca-Cola red-clad Santa in ads where he was rewarded for his delivery of presents by having a Coke and cookies. And so when I was a kid, we had a little stuffed Santa Claus when I grew up in Atlanta with a little tiny Coca-Cola.
We actually had the exact same stuffed Santa Claus in our house as well with the tiny bottle of Coke, and that's in Los Angeles. So it's not just Georgia.
Yeah. But what's interesting is the origin, the real purpose behind this ad was to attract, you know, kids as Coca-Cola consumers. And the real background goes back to the year 1912 when Coca-Cola was sued by the federal government in a suit that could have put them out of business. And one of the accusations was that Coke was trying to appeal to children with this drink that had an addictive drug, caffeine, in it. And ever since then, Coke has avoided, at least in the United States, showing children under 12 consuming their product. But that didn't mean that they didn't try to appeal to them through school programs, or they would, you know, have kids go for a tour of the local Coca-Cola bottling plant and give them rulers that said Coca-Cola on them and things like that. So the Santa ad was certainly intended for kids, because Coke knew that if you can instill wonderful good memories and the taste of Coca-Cola at a young age, they would become lifelong consumers.
So it has become so ingrained, at least in American society, that this year when Coke released their ad, there was a fairly large outcry. People complained that Santa Claus didn't wink at the kid at the end of the advertisement, and that the Santa never handed the young man a Coke. I mean, people are wrapped up. One person said, they ruined my Christmas.
Well, the funny thing is, this wasn't in America. This was in the UK. This was in England. So for the last 21 years in England, they have a Coca-Cola truck with Santa Claus on the side and on the back of the truck, brightly lit, that goes throughout the country. And it's become embedded in England, as this is the way that Christmas starts, somewhere around the beginning of December. And there was a huge outcry that their TV adverts, as they put it, didn't have Santa coming to life and winking and handing a Coke to a kid. Apparently, they don't have the it's not forbidden to show children drinking Coke in England.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, apparently, he's never winked. This is kind of an example of how an urban myth can begin. He did come to life, however. You know, he would be animated, and he would hand a Coke to a kid. And they're having a complete fit over there.
But never in any Coke ad did Santa wink at anybody. Is that what you're saying?
I don't think so. I haven't been able to find one, and the company says he didn't. But it's a good idea. They should have him wink now.
I'm speaking with author Mark Pendergrast. His book is called For God, Country, and Coca-Cola. And as we head into the holiday season, we're examining the history of how Coca-Cola kind of invented our image of Santa Claus. Now, they changed over to polar bears for the most part in the 1990s. Why?
Well, the polar bears are not necessarily Christian, so that might have had something to do with it. Maybe they were trying to be more diverse. It was sort of an accident that the polar bears happened in the first place. There was kind of a shootout between McCann Erickson, the traditional Coke advertiser, and Creative Artists Alliance, CAA, which was Mike Ovitz from Hollywood. And he was saying, oh, we can do much better ads with Hollywood directors like Francis Ford Coppola. Well, their ads weren't that good, but they did create this first polar bear computer simulation of these, you know, polar bears watching the northern lights and sighing with contentment as they drank Coke. And then they realized, hey, we can, you know, we can show mama polar bear giving a Coke to baby polar bear as a reward.
Oh, and they bypassed the rule on not giving it to kids because it's
exactly.
A cub.
Exactly. Yes, yes, exactly.
Very clever. So,
and then, you know, later on when polar bear habitat was clearly in danger because of global warming, they gave money beginning in 2011 to the World Wildlife Fund to try to protect polar bear habitat. So it kind of matched their advertising.
Their branding. Let's listen to a bit of a commercial from 2012 featuring Coke's famous polar bears. So it's hard to, you have to kind of imagine what's going on since polar bears don't actually talk. But let's compare that with an ad from 1995. This was when, this was called Santa Pack.
New Coca-Cola Santa Packs, the only real holiday refreshment. Look for this display at your store.
Holiday refreshments, what will you bring? Unwrap a Santa Pack.
I mean, they're chanting Santa Pack there, so still all in on Santa as of 1995. But why Christmas season in particular for Coke? I mean, when I think of an evening, Christmas Eve or something, I'm thinking about drinking apple cider and eggnog. I'm not thinking about drinking a Coke.
Well, it all goes back to kids again. I mean, what is the best time of year for children? It's Christmas when you get all these wonderful presents, and why not attach it to Santa? So when you leave something for Santa, you know, it's not just milk and cookies, it's Coke and cookies. So it's and Coca-Cola really is best when it's ice cold. So, you know,
oh, not in Europe. They drink it without ice.
Well, they're insane. I once was on a German program. You know, I have the original formula of Coca-Cola in my book. It was a big deal. And so they flew me over to Germany, and they gave me this lukewarm Coke that they had made from my formula. And they said, did it taste like Coke? I said, yeah, it tastes sort of like flat, awful lukewarm Coke.
Right. All right.
But,
well,
it really deserves to be ice cold. But, you know, I don't think that they've backed away from Santa. You know, I think that the some of the best Coca-Cola advertising, and it's because I'm a baby boomer, but I like the sort of heartland, heartwarming ads.
Yeah.
When they start doing rap music, it leaves me cold. So that, I love the Santa and the polar bears.
That's author Mark Prendergast, who wrote the book For God, Country, and Coca-Cola. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
Coca-Cola is making a big bet on Africa. The consumption of soft drinks has declined in the U.S., but the Atlanta-based company hopes Africa offers a chance for major growth. The company isn't just sending vending machines, though. It's also shipping an experiment in social entrepreneurship, a kind of community center in a box that also happens to sell Coke products. GPB's Bradley George reports.
They're called eco-centers. The first four letters are Coke, spelled backward. And they're popping up from the plains of Tanzania to the coast of Ghana. A video produced by the company shows drummers, musicians, and dancers at the opening of an eco-center in Rwanda. President Paul Kagame, Coke CEO Muhtar Kent, and the Reverend Jesse Jackson cut the ribbon. Eco-centers look like concession stands painted in the red and white of the Coke logo. Each unit sells consumer goods, including Coca-Cola and other beverages the company produces. But Coke says eco-centers are meant to be community gathering spots. This one in Rwanda is set up next to a soccer field. Most offer water filtration systems and solar-powered outlets for charging cell phones.
You have to make sure that the tension between what you want to do for your business and the positive aspect of what you want to do for the community is really working.
Bia Perez is Coke's chief sustainability officer.
And one can't be a trade-off for the other.
The company won't say how much it's spending on eco-centers, but its rollout comes as Coke makes major investments in Africa, $17 billion by 2020. Coca-Cola is betting the continent's burgeoning middle class may develop a thirst for its beverages.
This is a way to get rooted in the community and get the community to support Coca-Cola's operations, and other multinationals have been doing this as well.
West Virginia University professor Usha Haley studies how big companies use social entrepreneurship in emerging markets. She says there's not a strong correlation between those investments and corporate profits. But Haley says corporate interests usually come first, and it's not always clear whether governments in these countries will be good watchdogs.
The problem is, what happens when the media spotlight is removed from these eco-centers? Who's running them? Who's making money off them?
Coca-Cola says it's committed to eco-centers for the long term. Its goal is to open more than 160 in Africa by the end of the year. It's expanded the project to Vietnam and plans to take it to other parts of the developing world in the coming years. For GPB News, I'm Bradley George in Atlanta.
Women have made huge strides in the legal profession, but the gaps are still significant. Female lawyers make about 10% less than their male counterparts across the board, and only 17% of equity partners at law firms are women. A new documentary examines the causes and the consequences of that, and it's called Balancing the Scales. It's based on 20 years of interviews by Atlanta filmmaker and attorney Sharon Rowan, and she joins me in the studio. Hi there.
Hi.
20 years of interviews means that this has been on your mind for a very long time. Why?
Since 1994. Well, it started out as just wanting to talk to these outsized personalities of these women who had paved the way. But later on, it got to where another layer was peeled back, and I started thinking about generational differences because the different generations were telling me different things. And then after that, I started thinking about societal and cultural barriers and how we all are fish in the water of our culture and can't really see the implicit bias that we carry.
So let's hear from one of the extraordinary women that you spoke with. This is Carol Hunstein. She sits on the Georgia Supreme Court now. She was the first female president of the Council of Superior Court Judges, but I was really struck by her description of how she got started.
You know, when I passed the bar in '76, I couldn't get a job searching a title. But I would go out to the Fulton County Jail on a Monday morning, get a free breakfast, and a misdemeanor case appointed. If I did a good job, hopefully, the family of that particular defendant might refer some other business to me. And I just hung out a shingle because I couldn't get a job.
So I assume that's of an older generation of when you really had to struggle to get every single case.
Well, that was a little bit later in the South. It happened that way. But some of the women that I interviewed actually started practicing law in the 40s and in the 50s, and their struggles were even, crazier. That not only could I not get a job, you know, the law schools didn't have a women's bathroom.
And you spoke with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, for one, a Supreme Court justice now, but she talked a lot about how the only way she was able to succeed was because her husband supported her career. How often did that idea of having to give up kids to remain a lawyer and a successful lawyer come up?
It came up in every single interview, and not only because I asked that question, it's because that particular issue is on everybody's mind. Every woman that practices law, that works in any profession or any field, has these impossible decisions to make about, do I pursue my career, and if I do that, do I have time to raise a family? Because it's the culture that's telling us that it's the woman who normally would step back. And that is a belief, a kind of an implicit bias that is held not only by the men in our society, but by everyone in our society, including the women themselves. So they themselves feel like they have to step back. And that's a hindrance if you're interested in having a full career or want to get to the top of a profession.
So let's hear another thing that really kind of surprised me. You spoke with a woman named Therese Stewart. She's an associate justice on the California First District Court of Appeals, openly gay. And in your documentary, she actually thinks that being a lesbian helped her.
I was actually once told by one of my partners, you know, that he thought I was better off for being a lesbian because I was viewed more like one of the guys. And that was perceived as a good thing, which told me, well, I guess being a guy is better than being a girl.
What is different in the legal profession? Because in many cases, being not just a woman but also gay would really hinder you. What is changed in the culture of the law that being gay might help?
Well, I think that the legal profession is inherently conservative. I don't think that in general and across the United States that it is a particularly progressive socially profession. So people are conservative, and I think that that was a joke. But what the—
You don't think she was serious?
She was told that, and I think that the people that were telling her that were kind of serious, but I don't think that they really thought that, what I think they really thought was being a guy is better than being a girl. That's what I think they thought.
But it might harken back to the fact that they feel like she's not going to have conflicts with children and at home.
Yes,
that's
absolutely
not always the case with a gay couple, but that's the perception.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, so let's hear a little bit of what you of your interview with U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She actually began with the ACLU in the 1970s, and she argued gender equality cases before the Supreme Court. Here she is.
It took a reborn women's movement. Women all over began to complain about injustices. They were, as I said, everyday women. The time was ripe for the court to understand that discrimination against women was truly unfair.
So what do you think? I mean, there's a kind of a delicate balance in your documentary, because there seems to be a universal acceptance of how far women have come since the days of the 1940s and 50s. And yet there's also a kind of impatience with the fact that they're still struggling to get partnerships. They're still struggling to get judgeships. So how did you sort of straddle that line?
Well, I think that the type of bias that women and minorities have encountered has moved from explicit to implicit. And I think that in a lot of people's minds, that means that we have, you know, we don't have to worry about
spoken
that anymore.
Spoken to unspoken.
well, not even unspoken. I mean, it could be spoken, but not in the same explicit terms. You know, for example, if women talk in a different way or a more aggressive way, they might say, well, you're being too aggressive. You know, that's spoken, but it's a little more implicit than saying, you know, something like, we don't hire women. So I think that a lot of younger women today feel like that battle is over, especially when they come out as younger women. They feel like, I can get hired, I can do this work. And it's only after a few years that the actual issues that are still unfair to women in the workplace and in the legal profession make themselves apparent to them.
Well, it's a really interesting documentary. Atlanta attorney Sharon Rowan, her documentary is called Balancing the Scales. It's being screened tonight at 6:30 at the Midtown Art Cinema in Atlanta. Sharon, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Georgia's Stewart Detention Center in Lumpkin is one of the largest immigrant detention centers in the country. It is run by a private company. There are many just like it. Critics say those facilities are problematic. And this month, the Homeland Security Advisory Council said privately run centers should be phased out. But a separate subcommittee wants to continue using private immigrant detention facilities. With us is Azadeh Shashahani. She's the legal and advocacy director with Project South, which is based in Atlanta. Hi.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So let's go first to the advisory council that said these privately run facilities should be phased out. What was their reasoning?
Well, so the subcommittee came out with a report first saying that there needs to be better oversight of these facilities, but because of the rising population of detained immigrants, the government has no choice but to rely on privatized detention facilities for now.
That's the subcommittee that wants to continue using them.
Right. And then the report went to the advisory committee to the Department of Homeland Security, and there was really a stunning outcome. So 3/4 of the members of the advisory committee decided to adopt the recommendations on better oversight of facilities generally, but they decided to oppose the recommendation of the report on basically continuing with privatized detention. They felt that the government needs to really make an effort to phase out privatized detention facilities.
And why?
Because of the record of abuse by private prison corporations, because they don't actually substantially save on cost, and because, as a Department of Justice report had indicated earlier, there is shortcomings on a variety of fronts, such as safety and security in facilities run by private corporations.
Now, according to the USA Today, a spokesman for the private detention contractor CoreCivic said this, quote, the company supports the needs of our government partner while providing a safe, humane, and appropriate environment for those entrusted to our care, end quote. And another private detention firm, GEO Group, says it has a long history of, quote, providing culturally responsive, safe, and humane environments that meet the non-penal needs of those individuals entrusted to the care of ICE. That's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, end quote. What are the abuses that bothered the advisory council that they said they had strong evidence for?
Well, so, there have been uprisings at facilities run by private corporations, including two hunger strikes here, protesting the conditions.
Here in Georgia.
Here in Georgia at the Stewart Detention Center in summer of 2014 and fall of 2015. There were two hunger strikes and protests by immigrant detainees at the Stewart Detention Center. Protesting the conditions, including reports of maggots being found in the food and the treatment that they were receiving by the guards. So that's just one example here in Georgia. Across the country, you have situations where the food is sometimes not edible or is not enough. There is not enough safety or security for the immigrants or for the employees at that facilities, because, again, the corporation is trying to maximize profits and cut corners.
How long does the average immigrant spend in one of these? Once they arrive at the center, how long are they usually there for?
It depends. It depends whether they're fighting their case or they have already agreed to be deported. If they have agreed to be deported, it could be a couple months or longer. If they're fighting their case, you know, they're afraid of going back to their home country because they could be tortured or they could face persecution, it could be years. And so, because of the conditions at these facilities, some immigrants might actually sign away their rights and decide to return back despite the risk that they face because they don't want to, you know, stay for years at one of these detention centers with the poor conditions that we just talked about.
What are the, if an immigrant arrives at one of these centers, what rights do they have and how are they different from an inmate who's an American citizen at, say, a prison or private prison?
So, you know, one thing to keep in mind is that these immigration detention centers are civil institutions. You know, the purpose is not really to punish anyone. The purpose is just to keep people until they're hearing. But the way these detention centers are run is actually more of a penal nature, you know, meant to punish people. So, there are reports of verbal abuse by some of the guards. Sometimes the sexual abuse has been documented. The hygiene issue, the work program where the basically immigrants at the facility are doing the work that the corporation would have had to hire regularly paid employees at regular wages. Immigrants at these facilities are performing sometimes in unsafe working conditions for between $1 to $4 a day.
So there are a few big questions now. The first is whether or not the recommendations of the Advisory Council were going to be adopted, whether their recommendation that privately run centers be phased out, whether that would actually occur, but also what happens after January 20th when the Trump administration takes power. Let's deal with the first one and whether or not there's an intention to actually phase out these privately run centers.
Well, that is the hope. You know, it depends on what Secretary Jay Johnson decides. But, you know, based on obviously the recommendation of the advisory committee and also what the Department of Justice decided earlier this year to gradually cut ties with private corporations, we hope that the secretary would follow suit. There are unfortunate signals coming from Trump in terms of his affinity for privatized corporations and privatized detention centers, and also his stated intent to crack down on immigrants and potentially deport 2 to 3 million immigrants, which if that is actually carried out, would mean that the population of detained immigrants would rise just astronomically.
And I should mention that Jay Johnson, who you mentioned, is currently the Secretary of Homeland Security.
Right.
The Department of Justice deals with prisons that handle American citizens, which is a separate system.
Or immigrants, but just in the custody of, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, so this leaves us where? I mean, for example, the Stewart Detention in Lumpkin, that is a huge facility. Are they just sort of waiting to find out what happens?
Well, you know, stock prices rose a lot after the election results.
Stock prices for privately run prisons.
Exactly. For example, for CCA and the GEO group after the election results were announced just because they could see what was coming. But, you know, I think we have to continue to push on this front. I think the recommendation from the advisory committee is very positive that we need to continue to build on and really communicate the message to the new administration that it makes no sense either on the safety or security or human rights or cost front to continue to deal with private corporations for running of our prisons.
We only have about a minute left. So without getting into the minute legal details, does the recommendation of the Advisory Council actually give immigrants who are in one of these centers a legal standard to argue in court?
Unfortunately not, but it sets a good precedent.
That is Azadeh Shashahani. She is the Legal and Advocacy Director with Project South. It's such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It is possible that men and women naturally communicate differently.
Ross kissed me.
No! Oh, my God! Oh, my God! Oh, my God!
It's unbelievable!
Oh, my God! Oh, my God! Oh, my God!
Okay, all right. We want to hear everything.
And then I kissed her.
Tongue?
Yeah.
Cool.
That is from the sitcom Friends. While men and women might speak differently, there's now some evidence there's no difference when we're writing. Brian Larson is an assistant professor of rhetoric and technical communication at Georgia Tech, and he recently spearheaded a study that looks at possible differences in communication between genders when we write. And Brian joins me now. It's good to have you.
It's good to be here.
Also with me again is Falguni Sheth. She's a professor of philosophy at Emory's Department of Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies. Hello again.
Hi there.
First of all, you guys tried to be as objective as possible, but when it comes to gender differences, how do you do that? How did you control for implicit biases?
Well, in the case of this study, we didn't count this as people. The computer counted the language variations.
So you took humans out of it.
Right. So the computer knows which texts are written by men and which are written by women, and it tallies up the characteristics that we were looking to study, and it told us whether there were any statistical differences between them.
Why did you focus on writing in particular? Because we have had studies in the past on how we speak, whether we use passive language, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, so not so much writing in particular, but professional discourse was interesting to me because a lot of the studies that show gender differences are done in environments where the men and women aren't working to achieve the same kinds of social objectives. So by looking at, in this study, for instance, looking at papers written by law students who'd had similar training for about a year and who were trying to achieve the same end, we could see whether that allowed them to focus on the task and to abandon any gendered habitual or habitual gendered differences in their language. So in other words, if we set men and women to the same task, do they communicate the same way? And the answer, at least in our study, was yes. They're indistinguishable. So the example you give of Ross and Rachel or whoever it was kissing on Friends, I don't remember anymore.
Could have been anyone.
It's been a while since I've watched that show. But that example, you have women communicating in the wild, so to speak. But they may be acculturated to communicate that way by all sorts of things going on in their lives. We push boys and girls towards different kinds of activities. And as a result of that, they probably develop different kinds of language that they use in their day-to-day lives. But we wanted to see whether once they become professionalized, any of those differences remain.
And the answer is no.
The answer is no, at least in the study.
Falguni, how significant is this?
I mean, it seems to me that it kind of reproduces something that at least feminist theorists have thought about for a long time, or at least a number of us, right? That that kind of identical or similar conditions of education, acculturation, will produce similar results between men and women. So, you know, I'm not sure it's that surprising per se.
To you, but it's surprising enough to other people that's getting quite a bit of coverage and attention. And part of that, I think, is because we've had so many studies in the past that have shown big differences between the way women and men speak. We've even had recent ones that talk that, like in a business meeting, they say women are more likely to be less demanding or to apologize when they enter in, right? Say, oh, I'm sorry, I may be wrong about this, or use that kind of mitigating language. So to a certain extent, this study kind of flies in the face of what we've known in the past.
Not so much, because it seems to me that a number of these other studies, they show the differences in the way that men and women communicate or express themselves, but they don't necessarily talk about the sources of those differences. So, and I think that's really where a lot more attention has to be paid. So I know that, for example, there are different sources that talk about different brain circuitry or wiring or something like that. But on the other hand, there's something in Brian's report, you call it typification theory. I would probably call it gender stereotypes, right, or certain kinds of norms or expectations that we adjust ourselves to our environments in order to engage or speak in the ways that we think will be the most receptive. And that has a very long history in terms of gender. So that, for example, I think when I was on your show last a few days ago, we talked about, you know, whether women, if women were more demanding, they might be able to achieve more.
Yeah, more demanding women end up earning more money.
But it's not clear that that's an absolute line, right? That in fact, if you're really demanding, it could work against you. In fact, because you're thought of as excessively aggressive, out of your league, etc. And this was one of the things that at some point also plagued, right, the candidacy of Hillary Clinton.
Nasty
that there
woman.
Was, yeah. Nasty, right. That kind of aggressiveness. And so it's not clear that there's this kind of infinite projection.
Well, that boundary is so sometimes, for example, women will be told to use communicative techniques that are more commonly associated with men. And one example is that women are sometimes told to deepen their voices because it makes them sound more authoritative.
Right.
But there's been a bit of a meme on the internet about something called vocal fry, which
that's
is where
we're going to go like this.
Yeah, that's yeah. when we talk like this.
That's vocal fry.
Which is a sort of Kim Kardashian kind of sound. But that is a deepening of the voice. Women are being criticized for doing it. Men do it all the time. I mean, Ira Glass is probably the most famous example.
Noam Chomsky never left vocal fry.
Exactly. And so the thing is, you know, we tell women, deepen your voice to sound more authoritative, but don't deepen it too much, or be more assertive to get what you need, but don't be bitchy or bossy. And it's that kind of, well, what's the double bind is, I need to do more of this, but I don't know how far is too much.
Okay, well, then let me put the same question to both of you, and let me start with you, Brian. Why doesn't that bleed over into a professional written communication?
Well, I think the reason it doesn't bleed over into professional written communication is that the models are clearer for our students, right? So if you're a law student and you've been reading court opinions and court briefs for a year, and you've got a professor who's been teaching you how to write them, you have a set of conventions, sort of like the gender conventions that Falconi was talking about before. You have a set of conventions that you can recognize. Now, you might not be able to articulate what they are, spell them out, but you know them when you see them. And so you begin to adopt those conventions in your writing. And the fact is you must be doing so well enough to pass as writing the same as your male counterparts. Even though some people have argued that legal discourse is essentially a kind of male discourse,
yeah.
Generally I think they've done that without evidence. That's sort of a thing that people just believe. My experience anecdotally, having taught these kinds of courses for many years, is that the women don't have any more difficulty learning how to do this kind of writing than the men do. But what they're doing is they're seeing models and they're following those models, and they're doing it just the same as the men are.
Falconi, let me ask you then the same question, which is, why do these differences in speech that are often influenced by society and culture and our upbringing, frankly, do not lap over, at least in Brian's study, in professional written communication?
Well, I think Brian has given a pretty good answer. It's because when men and women are being trained to write in that exact way. Now, at the undergraduate level, for example, even though there are generally loose models for writing papers, we're not necessarily dictating the quality or the kind of vocabulary that men and women are using, right? So often you're translating the way that you speak. And so if you speak in a way that conforms to certain kinds of gender expectations, you're more florid in your writing or in your speech because you're a woman, chances are you're going to kind of express yourself in that in a similar way. But in terms of, for example, styles of argument, it's not clear to me that there's a huge difference. There might be styles, there might be differences in vocabulary. Mm. And also because often women are kind of educated, trained, acculturated through their families, society, to always trivialize themselves, right? I mean, this is kind of the basis for a lot of women's studies, gender studies, which is to say, to always be self-deprecating because this is more acceptable than to be assertive and aggressive. And so when you're writing, you can see that would translate into, well, I think, or my opinion is, much more so than, I would say, you know, men of the same age who would just say, hey, this is the truth, these are facts, because they're not actually pressured into insisting that this is just their opinion.
My guests are Brian Larson, who's a professor of rhetoric and technical communication at Georgia Tech, and Emory professor Falconi Scheff. We're talking about Brian's recent study that finds men and women don't communicate differently when it comes to writing. And we would love to hear from you out there. Do you think men and women write differently or talk differently? You can call us at 404-500-9457 or just post to Facebook or Twitter. And here, Brian, may be the sticking point, because legal writing is very different than almost any other kind of writing, is it not? So we oftentimes, especially when we're thinking about, say, a novelist, say it's important that we include female novelists because you need women to be able to see, and both women and men to see, you know, the female perspective. So what if we're not writing a technical brief? What if we're not writing a court reporting and we're writing something like a memo to our staff? Are women, do you think, more likely to write in that mitigating knowledge? I may be wrong, but I think this is true, but.
Yeah, so there was another study that came out this year by some folks at the University of Southern Alabama. I'm not really sure what the name of the school is, but they looked at the same kind of, well, they used a different study design, but they looked at a similar question with regard to students in business communication. And they found, again, that there were very few differences between male and female writers. So I think if you think about it in terms of professional communication, we should anticipate that there might be more similarities than differences.
Certainly, as opposed to when we get into fiction.
Well, or letter writing. I mean, the early studies that looked at differences in letter writing found that there were that women were writing more in this involved end of the involved informational spectrum, so more use of verbs describing interior mental states, more use of first-person pronouns, for instance, like I and we, instead of third-person pronouns like he and they. That kind of writing, and Twitter, for instance, if you think about Twitter, there are some studies that show that women are more prone to use certain emoticons or strings of exclamation marks in their tweets than men are. So that reminds me a little bit, again, of the Friends excerpt you use, right? The volume and the intensity of the conversation the women were having compared to the men is reflected also on Twitter. But that's not a professional context. Women aren't trained to write in that situation. They're translating what they might say out loud into their tweets, and I think that's what Flavia was saying. For better or for worse,
you know, women. It at some level, it's much more acceptable for women to be much more emotionally expressive than it is for men. And so, if that's how you were writing, and even in terms of novel writing, 17th, 18th, 19th century in the Western world, writing fiction was one of the few accepted modes of expression for, not just modes of expression, but professional vocation, right? So you could actually be a novelist when the rest of the professions were closed to you.
Although I should mention that there were a number of well-known novelists who wrote under the man's name, mm-hmm. George Eliot, for example, mm-hmm. who was really Marianne Evans, because they wanted to get more success and be taken more seriously. And we should mention that very few people knew a woman was writing the novel. They couldn't tell the difference.
So in a way, that kind of confirms the study that Brian did, right? That actually, if you don't know the name, and in fact, this has a lot to do with perception, that we're perceiving women and men to be expressing themselves in different ways.
Okay, we have like 4 minutes left, and I apologize in advance for getting into what may be a sticky topic. But here's the thing. Many of our studies into the way women and men speak differently, I find impossible to separate from social norms. So they have done all these studies in the 60s, 70s, 80s, even into the 90s that show women are more likely to talk about romantic engagements. Women are more likely to talk at length, for example. But how are we to separate that from what were the accepted roles for a woman and what are the accepted topics for a woman?
Because you're talking about content. Content is different from form. And this is where the writing differences evaporate in Brian's study. It's about form. Can you show people the proper form of argumentation? Whereas what you're talking about is the kinds of topics that women talk about outside of professional contexts.
And I think some of those earlier studies about oral differences have also come under fire. I mean, so for instance, studies that look at whether women are interrupted more often than men or whether women interrupt women more often than they interrupt men don't always consider what counts as an interruption that's kind of a face-challenging interruption, sort of like, you know, Donald Trump saying wrong while Hillary Clinton is talking, versus an affiliative interruption where you're telling me a story and I say, oh, I can't believe that happened.
Which is a positive.
Right. I interrupted you, but I interrupted you in a way to reinforce your telling of the story and actually encourage you to go on. And those kinds of interruptions in some earlier studies might have been counted the same way. And they really need to be teased apart. And that's language is so complicated, and the way we use it is so complicated that the studies themselves sometimes have to be looked at real closely.
And then what, Falgani, about the sort of universally accepted truths, like women complain but they don't want a solution, whereas men hear a complaint and they want to solve it immediately. What about those kind of things?
I don't know what to tell you. I'm not a linguist. I'm not a cognitive scientist on this one. I mean, and I'm not a psychoanalyst. But, you know, I mean, it seems to me that those may actually also be acculturated, right? That this is a way in which women are taught to express themselves that's not necessarily threatening. Right? So they complain, but they're not necessarily kind of encouraged to find solutions. And I wonder if in each increasing generation, right, we are going to see a bunch of differences as people become more aware that these are different ways that we are raising men and women.
It is fascinating. That is Falguni Sheth, professor at Emory's Department of Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies, and Georgia Tech professor Brian Larson. He led this study on how women and men communicate differently in writing. Thank you both so much.
Thanks.
Thank
it was
you.
Great to be here.
So what do you think about this? Do you think men and women communicate differently, or is some of that difference part of our upbringing and society? If you have thoughts on this, you know how to reach us. Call us at 404-500-9457. Find us on Facebook or Twitter.